I'm Melissa Quanlund. I'm the co-director of our global security program. I've been almost half of UCS 40 years, and I'm very optimistic about the future role of U.S. nuclear weapons, which is the topic of our panel today. We have two really great speakers. The first to go will be Jeffrey Lewis, who's currently at the New America Foundation, and he is deeply involved in trying to get the Obama administration to do the right thing, to get Obama to walk the talk, as he's been talking. I have this like official bio every time, it's not even ridiculous. I got to know Jeffrey a few years ago when he came to Cambridge. He was the executive director of managing the Adam Project at the Kennedy School of Government. It was not a match made. Jeffrey runs a very irreverent blog. I recommend it to everybody. ArmsControlWonk.com. There have been occasions when four-letter words have been on this site, most of all by Jeffrey. And the Kennedy School decided they didn't really like the fact that there was this person who had this kind of official was doing this blog. That was the least of the difficulties. So Jeffrey would come to our house and have dinner and, you know, complain about these things. And it's public, right? Of course. And he then gratefully returned to Washington, where he is continuing the blog and continuing to do his very good work. I have one more anecdote. So he would come over for dinner, and you know, in advance of one of these times, to a 14-year-old daughter, and we said, "Oh, Jeffrey's coming for dinner." She goes, "Oh, God, it's so exhausting when he's here," because he is an unbelievable energy, multitasking. You know, he's blogging and twittering, writing papers at the same time, reviewing things. It's just unbelievable. I don't get embarrassed. Our second speaker is Raymond John Lowe. He's a professor at UC Berkeley. I don't have any personal anecdotes. And he is one of our, you know, none of us at UCS have security clearances. We do a lot of work. We can get pretty far with our physics background in doing effectively peer review on the nuclear weapons labs and you know, things like missile defense. But ultimately, we often hit the brick wall of, yeah, but you don't really know. Because you don't have security clearance. And then we pull out of our secret closet either Dick Garwin or Raymond. But he does, and he works with us. And I cannot tell you how invaluable that is to our work. I mean, it would really be impossible for us in the global security program to be as effective as we are, wherever that is, without people like him. Raymond is a bona fide genius. He has been received the MacArthur Genius Award. Yes, yes, it's true. And he has, and he's also served on many oversight boards of the weapons labs of being at the University of California. He has tried to get them to be honest, and whether or not, he lets people know. So he will, he'll be stuck it up. And I'm now going to turn it over to Jeffrey Lewis.
Great, well, thank you. Very kind introduction. I feel like I'm going to disappoint everyone because I'm not going to swear. Take my pants off or something.
I have never seen him.
So, I have been asked to talk about the ongoing nuclear posture review. If you will indulge me, I'm going to start before we get to the substance by spending a little bit of time on issues of process, because as boring and tedious as they are, the process is often much more important than the substance in Washington. I have closely followed the NPR. On the plane on the way up, I decided to sit and make a list, and I think I've had the nuclear posture review. Sorry, I thought you mentioned it. Yeah, you're right. I will explain what a nuclear posture review is in a second, but on the plane, on the way up, I made a list of all of the meetings I've participated in. And I think I've been in clearly over a dozen meetings with sort of similar number of senior officials over the last 6 months. So I think I have a pretty accurate view of what's going on. So what is a nuclear posture review? It's worth noting that a nuclear posture review is precisely what the last word is. It's a review. When it is done, nothing happens, or nothing has to happen. Changes to U.S. nuclear weapons policy are embodied in documents that the president signs. Now they're called presidential policy directives. Every administration calls them something different. The Bush administration would call them national security presidential directives. And ideally, a nuclear posture review will set up options so that then the president can implement them in the form of directives. But that doesn't necessarily have to happen. And so if I can briefly talk about the two previous nuclear posture reviews we've had, I think it will kind of illustrate the very limited role that these things play. We've had three. This is now the third nuclear posture review. People are starting to expect that every time a new administration takes office, they will do a new review. But it wasn't always that way. Each of the reviews has been done for very different reasons. The first nuclear posture review was done at the beginning of the Clinton administration. It was something that the administration itself wanted to do. It wanted to do it because the Cold War had ended, we had 12 years of Republican presidents, and so the Clinton administration initiated a series of reviews throughout the Defense Department. There was a review of conventional forces called the bottom-up review. And the nuclear piece was something called the nuclear posture review. And without going into the sordid details, it was a catastrophe. As a consequence of the 93-94 nuclear posture review, the Clinton administration at the end decided to leave in place the existing nuclear weapons guidance, which dated to 1981, which suggested that we needed to be able to fight and win a protracted nuclear war with the Soviet Union. That gives you a sense of how bad the posture review is when that guidance still seems to be better than something you might do. And the Clinton administration didn't get around to issuing new guidance until about 1997, when in the course of START negotiations, START 3 negotiations with the Russians, it became clear that the United States could not undertake further reductions unless the guidance was changed. And having learned its lesson, the Clinton administration did an internal White House-only review and basically just announced the results. And that was it. Which should have been the first sign that nuclear posture reviews are not necessarily successful endeavors. So why did we do it again? Well, when the Clinton administration decided that it was going to move to implement the reductions that had been agreed under START 2, which the George H.W. Bush administration had negotiated, it was basically the Clinton administration decided they would undertake those reductions even if the Russians didn't ratify, so we could get on with the business of negotiating even deeper reductions in START 3. Some of you may remember the Republican Congress of the 1990s. It had a rather poor relationship with the president. And so the Congress used its power of the purse to refuse to provide any money to undertake any such reductions, thus locking us into this kind of archaic START posture. There were sort of battles over this for a couple of years. And eventually, the administration prevailed upon the moderates in the Senate to accept removing this requirement that no money could be spent on reductions. But because of the toxic relationship between the White House and Congress, the catch, the detail was, such reductions could only be undertaken after a nuclear posture review was conducted, which of course was scheduled for beginning January 2001, after Clinton left office. It was a delay in that. So then we had the 2001 nuclear posture review. The Bush administration came in. They didn't particularly want to do it. They didn't really care. This was not something that Congress felt deeply about. It was a delay in tactic. And so they handed it off to some contractors, a guy named Keith Payne at a place called the National Institute for Public Policy. And it produced, I think, a document that is rather middling, which then, of course, was leaked in part to the press and caused no improvement in the Bush administration. So why would we do this a third time? Well, you may recall that the Bush administration decided they wanted to pursue something called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, a new nuclear weapon. And when Congress refused to provide money for that, they pursued something called the Reliable Replacement Warhead, yet another new nuclear weapon. And the now Democratic Congress recalled that there was this clever idea of not necessarily saying no, but saying, we're not going to decide until you do a nuclear posture review, which was conveniently scheduled for 2009, after Bush left office. So here we are. Exact same scenario. You have a new president coming in, saddled with a posture review that was really only designed to keep the last guy from mucking things up. Right, of course. So here we are. No one listens to me, but my strong advice to the people I was working with was don't do it. Don't have another imposter review. Have the president do an internal review, get a couple of interesting questions that you want the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to answer, and ask them to answer those questions. Call that a nuclear imposter review and move on. Now, as I say, no one listens to me. What we have today is, like the other two previous nuclear imposter reviews, basically a Department of Defense-led endeavor. Now, in drafting the legislation, the Democratic Congress knew that a Department of Defense-led endeavor was likely to produce something that looked a lot like a status quo. If you think about it, if you ask a one-star admiral in the military and a deputy assistant secretary what ought the purpose of our nuclear forces be, they're going to tell you what the purpose has been. Right? And so Congress initially decided to make this a truly interagency process, in which instead of this classic model where the Secretary of Defense does recommendations and then you take them to what's called a Principals Committee, in which the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Energy and the Vice President and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff make a decision. They would set up interagency working groups that would agree on sets of options, send those up to the Secretary of Defense, and then spit those out to this second formal interagency process. And the theory was that that would produce a more fulsome accounting of our interests as they relate to nuclear weapons, not just narrow DOD interests, but broader international implications. As we'll talk about in a minute, I don't think that that happened. So the nuclear posture review that we have had this year has proceeded in three phases. The first phase was also a legacy of the Bush administration.
We've done like 5 minutes.
Six.
Well, that's perfect. That's exactly where I'm going to be. It's proceeded in three phases. The first is, as you all know, the surgery with the Russians expires in December. And so the administration was under incredible time pressure to negotiate a new treaty with the Russians, but did not want to be in the position of negotiating a treaty with the Russians that entailed reductions before finishing a nuclear posture review, because then Senator Kyle and his friends will say, you went and cut the force before you even knew what the answer was. So through June, they did an expedited review in which they took the Bush administration guidance and said, what is the lowest level of warheads and delivery vehicles that we could live with if you didn't change the guidance at all? So without prejudging the outcome of the review, how low can we go? And that went through June, and sort of culminated in a principals committee meeting, which maybe some of you saw in the press is rather famous because Secretary Gates reviewed his effort to revive the reliable replacement warhead. Once the START piece was done, then DOD basically took over. And that process has run up to about now, where the Department of Defense essentially did an internal review in which these working groups were alleged to play a central role, but actually, as it turned out, were very unsatisfactory. And so for 3 months, the Department of Defense ran this study, I would say basically unsupervised by the White House, which was afraid of appearing to interfere with the outcome of the review. And now that the Department of Defense has essentially, as far as I can tell, completed the major aspects of the study, they're beginning to, what they would say, tee up options for the president, and they're sending them over to the White House. There'll sort of be a little bit of back and forth. And I think over the next few months, with ultimately the review coming out in, say, January or February, you will see leaks about decisions being made. Now, you may have heard that the president saw the NCAR, didn't like it, and sent it back. There was a story in The Guardian. There's another story that said the NSC now is fully engaged. It's not true, sadly. What has happened is, because the DoD completed this study, Secretary Gates went down to Huntsville, Alabama, and gave a talk where he announced there were likely conclusions of the NPR, which caught the White House a little bit by surprise. And I think the White House now realizes that they are fully boxed in and that there's not much they can do. But since they have moved into this phase where the Department of Defense is teeing up these their options with a strong recommendation, which, you know, in my mind is not actually an option, they're putting the best face on it. They're saying, yes, now we're engaged. Yes, now we're taking this seriously. And I will just briefly touch on substance. I think if we're going to see truly dramatic changes, the president's going to have to push back. So, just what do I think we're going to expect on substance, and then I will sit down. The president said he wants to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. security policy. There is no agreement on what that means. Some people have said maybe that means conventional weapons take over certain nuclear missions. Some people have said that maybe you eliminate the nuclear role. Some people say you eliminate a role for nuclear weapons, and some people say maybe you eliminate a major system. I've heard all three candidates from one official, and so I trotted those out in front of another official, and it was clear he'd never heard of them, but thought that was a really good taxonomy. I don't think they know yet what they count as transformation, but here's what I expect to see. I think you will see further numerical reductions. It's my understanding the United States proposed the lower warhead number in the START treaty negotiations of 1,500 warheads and was prepared to go even lower than that. And we can talk about why, but the Russians want a higher number of warheads and a lower number of delivery vehicles, missiles, and bombers. But this administration, I think for political reasons, will only make those reductions if they can be done in tandem with the Russians. Now, the good news is there have been concerns that we couldn't go much lower because there were fears that the large number of Russian tactical nuclear weapons would loom even larger, or that the Chinese would sprint up to parity. I think those are silly arguments. As it turns out, I think they are being beaten back in the interagency process, which is my pleasant surprise. I don't think those at this point are showstoppers, but I do think the requirement that strategic reductions occur in tandem with Russia will be difficult. Second, I think you're going to see a little movement on clarity policy, what we say our nuclear weapons are for, or when we say we would use them. Unfortunately, I think calculated ambiguity, which in other contexts I have called stupid, will remain our policy, but the administration is going to try to find some language to emphasize the deterrent role of nuclear weapons. No first use is off the table, but there is some discussion about saying the primary purpose of the weapons is to deter and respond to nuclear attacks. Now that's the question, is do you say the primary purpose, which I don't like, or do you say the sole purpose? I'd be willing to settle for the purpose and just remain silent about it, but there is now, I gather, a battle joined over the adjective. I know, it's my life. Sad. The third thing is extended deterrence. The need to extend the U.S. deterrent commitment to our allies is going to be the central argument. I jokingly say that we would love to have a sensible nuclear policy, but the Japanese won't give us permission. But that is basically the way the Department of Defense is treating this argument. And so one thing you may see is this, the United States has these archaic tactical nuclear weapons for Tomahawk missiles that can be put on attack submarines. They've sat in storage since 1991. They are supposed to be retired in 2013. But there is a group within the Department of Defense that over the Navy's objections wants to preserve this capability as a physical manifestation of our love for all things Japanese. I think this is crazy. I am doing my best to keep that back, but these extended deterrence questions play a shockingly large role. Next to last, decision time. I don't think this administration is willing to consider physical de-alerting of nuclear weapons, but they are willing to consider how you increase the president's decision time in a crisis. So that may take the form of changing the guidance to move to something like a British-like policy where the president says that he wants to take days, which I think would be a good thing. Chances are, however, it will be accompanied by a major program of investments in command and control systems so that, as one character said, if you want to extend decision time, there has to be someone to take a decision. So this may be a case where you get a salutary change in the guidance, but perhaps certain defense investments that are depending on the view, either wasteful or harmful. And then the final issue is warhead modernization. And Raymond will talk about this in much more detail, but I will just say that my observation is it is true that the Secretary of Defense, I believe, initially wanted to revive programs to build new nuclear warheads. I think that that is as much a political calculation about what is required on the Hill as it is a substantive judgment. But due to the great work of the Jasons, who, you know, they're members who may or may not be present, may or may not admit that they are Jasons, I actually think that this is a case where science has at least temporarily beat back what I think is a manifestly stupid idea. Oh, well, it doesn't really stand for anything. It's the Jasons are a group of eminent scientists who serve as independent technical consultants for the United States government on defense matters. Think, you know, what Dick Garwin is. And so I think that's the place that I want to leave it with, because I think it neatly goes into the things that Raymond's going to say, but it also illustrates, I think, the real important and continuing role of using science to make better public policy judgments.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here with Jeffrey, Elizabeth, and the rest of you to talk about the future of U.S. nuclear weapons, admittedly a very difficult subject that's all the more important for us to address, as you well know, because it gets far too little public attention. That's undoubtedly because it evokes and should evoke strong emotions for those who think about this topic. Elizabeth suggested that I consider technical issues such as the reliability of the current U.S. arsenal and the potential need for new warheads, as we've heard. And I'll attempt to do this based on my own understanding of such matters. Although I have participated in a number of relevant studies, I will offer personal views, and I do invite you to compare these with others' conclusions, both personal friends you may have and also official statements. Before addressing these issues, however, I suppose one might legitimately ask, why should I care about the future of U.S. nuclear weapons? And of course, in a room like this, many of you have your own answers, and you know that the answer depends on one's interests and responsibilities. But I'd like to suggest that there is a spectrum of reasons that are relevant. For example, those charged with the defense of our nation, for that community, they still do consider nuclear weapons as playing a key role as the military deterrent that might ultimately be called upon to ensure our survival. And perhaps at the other extreme of the spectrum, those interested in a so-called vision of a world free of nuclear weapons, for that community, it's also important that arms reduction be pursued under thoughtful, controlled actions that avoid risks of destabilization or even of greatly enhancing the potential for conventional warfare. And finally, let's say in between, purely from a pragmatic perspective, such arms control efforts as the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty can only be pursued under the condition that the U.S. arsenal is safe, secure, and reliable, in other words, not linking the CTBT to being a arms reduction treaty in and of itself. All of these reasons, across the full spectrum of perspectives, are encapsulated under the statement that so long as we have one, the U.S. must ensure that our nuclear arsenal is maintained responsibly. And in fact, that's been officially the purpose of the stockpile stewardship efforts, by which I mean not only the program within the Department of Energy for the past 15 years, but as many of you know, activities going back 50 years or more to to ensure the safety, security, and effectiveness of U.S. nuclear weapons. And this, the U.S., we have done very well, assuring safety, security, and effectiveness. And in particular, the stewardship program of the past 15 years has demonstrated that the arsenal can be maintained without the need for nuclear explosion testing. Now, some of you, in particular, if you've thought about this, might say that such nuclear testing had little to do with sustaining the arsenal, in fact, but was intended more for validating new weapons designs or perhaps for developing better understandings of weapons physics. Nevertheless, the U.S. national laboratories, production plants, along with relevant portions of the military, have been able to assess our nuclear stockpile as safe, secure, and reliable each year since the mid-1990s, well after the current test ban moratorium was begun, and that's a real accomplishment. Now, specific technical indications of success of stewardship include the ability to reestablish production of certified pits in Los Alamos using different methods, different materials, and different people than those who had been involved in the previous production of these components at Rocky Flats. As you recall, pits are the critical nuclear trigger for the secondary stage that provides the bulk of the explosive yield from a modern thermonuclear weapon. And, in case you've forgotten, Rocky Flats was shut down because of violations of environmental laws. The point is that pits are deep inside the nuclear explosive packet, the NEP of the warhead, and a changeover from wrought to cast plutonium for those with a metallurgical expertise. That change was quite significant. Yet this was successfully accomplished under the modern stewardship program. Other accomplishments include documenting that the effective lifetime of plutonium is at least, again, I'll say at least 85 to 100 years, possibly far longer. Despite this material, the plutonium continuously damaging itself due to radioactive sulfur radiation. This important research contribution from our own national laboratories means that the U.S., we have time to plan for the future of our arsenal before we might have to contemplate systematically replacing all the pits in the existing weapons. Finally, I know that stewardship has been successful in sustaining the legacy arsenal through so-called life extension programs that refurbish existing warheads. The W87 and W80 warheads have undergone their own LEPs, and the W76, which makes up the bulk of our current nuclear deterrent, is undergoing this life extension process right now. These refurbishments address any degradations that may be found in the weapons' nuclear explosive packages, and they can also include replacement of components outside the NEP, such as electronics associated with arming, fusing, and firing sets, or with safety and security features. In this sense, one can speak of our warheads being, in quotes, modernized. However, I should emphasize that none of this work under the LEPs involves enhancing the military effectiveness of our weapons. For this reason, I personally caution against use of the term modernization, yet one can understand that others may use this term with reference to our own stewardship program. Looking ahead, such refurbishments are technically feasible for sustaining the legacy arsenal, at least for the foreseeable future, which is really all we can talk about. The skills required for refurbishment have been demonstrated, and there is no reason that these cannot continue to be applied. In fact, the more we do, the more we learn how to be effective in refurbishment. In particular, concern that the weapons would drift away from well-tested designs due to the accumulation of small changes, effectively becoming new, untested designs over time. This concern is completely unwarranted. The laboratories, plants, and military custodians have been anything but this irresponsible. What changes have been made are, one, small in number, and two, excruciatingly, some have said excessively, carefully examined before being approved. In fact, the new production of W88 pits that I already mentioned is a case in point. I believe it took some 10 years or so to certify that process. Overall, the reliability of the legacy weapons has, if anything, been measurably improved for example, through enhanced so-called primary performance margins due to new boost gas systems technologies. Moreover, life extension programs are once-in-a-generation activities with refurbishments planned for 20 to 30-year periods, so there's really little opportunity for a lackadaisical growth. Nevertheless, one does hear that LEPs, and more explicitly, refurbishments, are not sustainable. At some point, we're told a different strategy will be needed for the U.S. nuclear arsenal. With such claims, one now hears of a spectrum of activities that need to be considered, ranging from refurbishment to replacement of warheads. Now, the latter, replacement, implies new designs, albeit without nuclear explosion testing, and therefore closely related to designs that have been previously validated by testing. You will recognize this as the approach used for, proposed for, the reliable replacement warhead, though there is currently no mention of developing new capabilities for nuclear weapons in the future. On technical grounds, I find no compelling evidence for the conclusion that the legacy warheads cannot be sustained through refurbishments. Legacy warheads cannot be sustained through refurbishments. I do see no support for that conclusion, at least for the foreseeable future. So how can there be such a discrepancy with official statements from those who should know? In large part, I think this discrepancy comes from a sloppiness in the language that's used. The same logic that concludes, quote, we cannot sustain refurbishments, has, in a different context, stated, quote, we can no longer make pits, or even, quote, we are the only nuclear weapon state that cannot make a nuclear weapon. What this logic ignores is that we as a nation chose to shut down production at Roswell Flats because of our society's priorities. Of course we could still make pits the old way, in violation of our values that currently place environmental concerns at a higher premium. Still, it's notable that we are now able, under stewardship, to make new pits in a manner consistent with those broader priorities. With this in mind, it's worth re-examining the conclusion that a strategy of refurbishment is not sustainable. That conclusion may well be valid if our priorities change, and if we choose not to maintain the legacy arsenal of nuclear weapons. For example, in the post-9/11 world, it's plausible that warhead surety, that is, safety and security, could have an even higher priority than ever before. If so, this could effectively amount to placing new requirements on the arsenal. And it is under such circumstances, such choices, that refurbishment may be inadequate to the task. Another example stems from the recent history of the stockpile's downsizing, as you already heard from Jeffrey. As you may know, the size of the active U.S. arsenal is now, nuclear arsenal, is now smaller than it's been for decades, and there are prospects for further reductions. This may motivate a strategy intermediate between refurbishment and replacement, whereby nuclear components from disassembled warheads are reused for sustaining the enduring stockpile. As always, with the requirement of no new military missions and no resumption of nuclear explosion testing, reuse, in quotes, could therefore be part of a strategy that benefits nuclear arms control and non-proliferation as a stockpile is reduced in size. These are early days, however, and much more work needs to be done in order to fully define, let alone understand, what a reuse strategy might actually entail. Absent changes in requirements, a choice we make, refurbishment can sustain the legacy arsenal. And there is as yet no choice or circumstance that I know of that has made a convincing case for the new warhead designs required as a replacement strategy for sustaining the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Now, I have a few words about a world free of nuclear weapons, if I have a minute or two.
Oh, yeah, you actually have more than that.
Well, I'm not going to make up for Jeffrey.
Okay, so I want to move beyond the immediate future and make a few comments or briefly address the long-term vision of a world free of nuclear weapons. There will be much work needed to identify the concrete steps or the concrete actions required for achieving this vision, and even more work after identifying those steps, even more work to actually accomplish those steps. Some of the key tasks that lie ahead from a technical perspective include the following five. Let me enumerate those that I've been thinking about. One, define more explicitly what a, quote, world free of nuclear weapons would be, paying attention both to the range of activities and materials that would be allowed for current nuclear weapons states and to the degrees of latency and incipient capabilities accepted for current non-nuclear weapons states. Two, identify, based on technical and military considerations, what, if any, intermediate steps and assessment points can be defined as logical stages, if you want, on the way to zero. Three, compare the nuclear case with experience gained from the global prohibition of biological weapons, another deadly technology, as you know. Four, determine the role of cooperative research in supporting a nuclear weapons-free world. I should clarify, internationally cooperative efforts. These efforts could contribute, for example, to increased transparency between current nuclear weapon states and to mutual confidence building between nations. And five, to specify the potential role of, or I might say the necessary role of nuclear weapons laboratories, both in a world free of nuclear weapons and on the way to such a condition. In closing, I want to turn again to the question, why should we be thinking about a world free of nuclear weapons? Once again, there are many reasons, but the key one from the present perspective, especially for us technical people, key one, nuclear weapons do represent the most powerful technology developed to date. Biological weapons may in principle, or are in principle, equally deadly. And who knows what new, yet more powerful technologies will be uncovered through future work. We surely expect such developments to happen with greater power of technology and science in the future. And the point is that we in the scientific community need to learn how to control new technologies as they are discovered and put them to the best benefit of humanity. Thank you.
For questions and comments. I don't know, is there a mic in the back, or we're just going to go freeform? We're going to go freeform. I actually want to start with a clarifying question. Raymond, when you were saying, you know, one hears, you know, arguments that we need to do X or Y, who does one hear them from?
So I think I was referring to what's been in the covered by the news media for the past months and even the past few years. I think it's fair to say that the Commander Strategic Command has been quoted on a number of occasions, including on armscontrolblog.com, as making such statements, and I believe also some of the directors of the nuclear design laboratories have on occasion been quoted as saying such things. But Jeffrey can correct me on that. Am I misquoting anyone that you know?
Right. Okay, the floor is open. Yes.
Hi. I have a quick comment. Hopefully you commented a great deal about the safety and security of the U.S. arsenal. I'm wondering if you would comment on the safety and security of other arsenals, including Pakistan.
It's, of course, a very sensitive topic. It's very difficult to discuss. And as you can imagine, I don't want to focus specifically on Pakistan, but for instance, Pakistan or any foreign nation will always be very worried about revealing how it may possibly be securing its weapons. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that's in the open literature. I believe it's actually based on substantive military and military discussions that there are very significant security measures that are in place. I will say anecdotally, I myself have been to Pakistan, and the military are extremely professional. So I've observed as an independent outsider, albeit just a university professor, very much from what appears from our military officer colleagues, are very professional, very concerned about these issues. Can I guarantee that they're as secure as one would like? Perhaps not, but they certainly do take that very seriously. Same for our Russian counterparts and so on. The issue of safety and security also should come back to what I will call a system-wide safety and security. And so here I want to be careful how I say this just to give a picture. But there are things you can do of embedding, you know, secret mechanisms in every warhead and all that. But if you start doing that, you know, sort of at one end of the arsenal, and it takes you decades to get to the other end of the arsenal before you've implemented all sorts of new things, the reality is the whole system, the whole arsenal, is still vulnerable. And that's an issue, that system-wide strategizing that I believe has not really been talked through or discussed thoroughly enough. That's my personal opinion.
Do you
want to
add to that?
I think the only thing I would say is one doesn't want to be polemical, right, about the risks that are entailed. But if you think, as I do, that the deterrence that you get from nuclear weapons is achieved with having the capability rather than the deployment of large alert forces, you know, the growing size of the Pakistani arsenal and the instability of the country is worrisome, independent of whatever technical measures they might make.
Right. Good point. Yes, please.
One of the things, I think you touched on this without explaining it at all fully, is what are the chances that if we give up deterrence completely, that we increase the possibility of conventional war?
I think that's a really fascinating question, because there were, sadly one of them has passed away, but there were sort of three much older figures who I really admire, who are were more skeptical about this sort of, we're worried about conventional war in a way I'm not. It was, you know, it's Tom Schelling, it's the late Michael Quinlan, and Michael May. And what I find interesting is, because for them World War II is within living memory, they can imagine that outcome. I mean, I have to say, given, you know, my experience in Europe, I cannot imagine, you know, French and German teenagers killing one another. So, at some level, I feel like this is almost just an impossible question to answer. It solely depends on whether you can imagine that, and that's almost entirely a function of age. But.
So, the reality, and I'll speak as a scientist, the reality is that we are trained in intelligence, and we're responsible and all that. And so, I think we have a special contribution, not just for technical matter, but that training does give us the opportunity and remind you the obligation to actually look at those issues. So, a little advertisement. This is Sir Michael Quinlan's last book that was published this year, Thinking About Nuclear Weapons. I don't necessarily agree with every comment in here, but it makes a very compelling, has a very compelling discussion on exactly this point. And the fact is, there are responsible people who have to think about these issues. I don't think, in my own opinion, that we've actually done a good job so far. It's very easy to anecdotally point to charts of number of war casualties or war dead over the years and point to the nuclear age and say, well, it looks like, you know, since World War II, it was horrible, hideous, that ever since then, you know, somehow nuclear weapons have solved this problem. Well, it's not quite that easy, but even starting with documenting, you know, war casualties over time, let alone making connections, and then we know, again, as technical people, correlation is not implied causality. Right? So there are really substantive issues there. I'm not sure that they'll fully answer to any one individual satisfaction, but I think we tend to be a little bit sloppy in the broader community. So let's take a position for the rest of the day. And I'd like to really invite people to look at this very, very, you know, hard way for the historical community to the technical community.
Jeff, you
wanted
to add something?
Yeah, that just caused me to remember something I think is very important, which is, you know, even if you could prove historically that nuclear weapons were essential to the establishment of a relatively peaceful economy, which large-scale war was not the continued existence of the weapons might not be necessary to maintain that new equilibrium. And so I think you're right that conceptually a lot of this is very impressionistic.
Okay, there was a second question in the second row, I think. Okay, so now you're not the first in line. The woman in front, please.
Jeffrey said that I believe that no first use is off the table. Does that include no first use against non-nuclear states?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So we have a negative security assurance that says the United States will not use nuclear weapons against, you know, states party to the NPT. But then there's this giant Warsaw Pact exclusion clause, which is odd because there's no Warsaw Pact to exclude. But it's funny because it's something like 54 of the 77 words of the assurance are dedicated to the exception to the assurance. And so one thing I have suggested is that, you know, this be stripped out and it be made more clear, and I think there's some possibility. But the real problem is we have this policy of calculating ambiguity, which is a terrible name, because we don't mean ambiguity. What we do is we make inconsistent statements. So the press person trots out and says, the United States has this commitment not to use nuclear weapons. And then the next sentence is, of course, you know, the United States, you know, all options are on the table when it comes to deterring and responding to weapons of mass destruction. And you can point out that logically these two sentences cannot coexist, cannot both be true, and then they just read the sentences again. So I'm hoping that there will be some effort to address that, but I'm not hopeful.
Jeffrey, correct me if I'm wrong, it's I mean, maybe officially there's a Warsaw Pact exclusion, but certainly people have thought about using nuclear weapons against, you know, Iran.
Right.
Korea, or lots of other cases.
But I mean, that's what they do, is they have a thing, right. There is a statement that clearly excludes that.
Right.
And then they say, well, but you know, on the other hand, it doesn't clearly exclude that. You know, I mean, this is when, so the African nuclear weapons treaty, right? The Treaty of Peladaba,
right,
has a security assurance in it. And so when we signed it, you know, Bob Bell, who was then the National Security Council staffer, went out and said, of course, by signing this negative security assurance, nothing in it obligates us.
We don't really need it.
And it's this thing.
Okay. There was a question back here, please.
Sort of a naive question.
Yes.
If we have something like 15, if the numbers we talk about are strategic nuclear missiles or whatever, something like 1,500. What is the largest arsenal of strategic nuclear weapons other than the U.S. and Russia? And assuming that the other countries have far fewer, is there any deterrent effect to keeping 1,500 as opposed to 150 each or 15 each? And I realize I'm throwing numbers around. I don't know.
So, you know, it's like 300, and it's the French or the British, right, at the next level. So, which is like a couple hundred, probably 200, maybe 130. Yeah. So it's, everybody else is sort of a few hundred, whereas, you know, we're at in excess of 1,000 for the Russians. Look, I don't think there's any deterrent benefit to having such gigantic numbers. I mean, I can repeat for you the arguments that people make, which is that, in this administration, this is willing to go lower. But if you go much below 1,000, they say, well, you know, the Russians have 4,000 tactical nuclear weapons, and so you know, those will loom relatively larger. They say, well, you know, the Chinese only have a few hundred, but maybe they'll be tempted to build up to the same number. The Japanese will be worried because they see we're going to a poor deterrence posture, so they think that leaves them out. I don't find any of these arguments compelling, and so I probably don't do a very good service to them when I present them. but I think as you start to look below, say, 1,000 warheads on several hundred delivery vehicles, those are the kinds of things you hear.
And just to clarify, there are some specific proposals that have been published, notably by Isidro and Jim Goodby, that basically amount to 500 in the active stockpile and 500 in reserve. So it quite consistent with what Jeffrey is saying. And I mentioned those two authors, but I want to emphasize that a number of other individuals, actually spanning the political or pop-gov spectrum, have come up with similar proposals. So one of the issues that's tied to this is, should we, the U.S., actually publicize our numbers as opposed to, as I think you know, trying to do the classifiers?
I wanted to add that UCS has also come up with that number of 1,000 for a total arsenal. Yes, I think you're next.
Okay. Would you care to comment on the pros and cons of whether or not you include munitions utilizing depleted uranium as a nuclear weapon? There's significant evidence that they kill radiation poisoning.
Yeah, I have a very technical answer, which, you know, I admit ahead of time, the technical consideration may not be the only ones that play a role. But first of all, I am, as a technical person, I'm not even pleased with considering chemical weapons as a weapon of mass destruction, let alone high explosive yield, conventional explosive yield weapons, let alone depleted uranium munitions. They're just not at all even remotely in the same category of destructive power of the nuclear weapon. So that's a very technical point, and the reason I, for me, is very important is nuclear weapon is just an unimaginably powerful and hideous one, but by the with the kind of effect that it can have. And if you don't want to take it from someone with, you know, many assigned to me a particular political perspective, you gotta look at Sir Michael Quinlan's point of view. He was really one of the key architects of the Cold War deterrent strategy. And I think you'll find similar kinds of comments there. So these are technical, but again, I acknowledge that with that, we intend to put the depleted uranium munitions in a very different category just about the kind of impact it can have. But, you know, excuse me, that doesn't mean that it's not worth looking at, and we open the door to many other topics, landmines, many, many other things that need to be looked at.
Are there other people that should be looking at
that? Well, depleted munitions, there's been work on this. There's a nice article by Steve Feder and Frank von Hippel that actually does a nice discussion about the risks, the health risks associated with the depleted uranium munitions. I believe it was. If you send me an email, I can get it out. It's on this computer. It's a very famous article because it actually tries to address some of these issues purely from a technical
perspective. There are two DVDs that are instructed. One is titled Beyond the Trees of Death. Another one is Poison Dust.
Well, I hate to say this. I don't want to reduce it to simplistic latitude, but as we all know, warfare is one of the worst things we can do to the environment, in general terms, including conventional warfare. And so that does have an immediate health impact, even to the non-combatants.
Okay, front row.
My name is Matt Schwartz. I'm on NAB, UCS. I'm also at a fairly new post. I'm the president of the NAB for an organization called the Project for Nuclear Awareness. I've never heard of it. And it's striking to me the illiteracy of the American public, that they simply have forgotten that nuclear weapons ever existed. If they remember that they know what a nuclear weapon is, then they don't know where they would be, what their power is, how many we have, how much it costs. Stephen Schwartz did a study to show that we spent $2.6 billion a year just to maintain the arsenal. When the American public might be faced with this information, they might actually use that information to help in regard to getting rid of these. My question to you is, what do you think the feasibility is and the impact of educating the public, having them become quite aware of what you think their potency would be with regard to interfacing with the legislators and both policymakers?
The user end is, so I will just say this, one of the reasons that we get killed on these issues year after year after year is because there are no Democrats in the United States Senate who care about this issue at all. They kind of care, but it's not a top priority. There's no one who is like John Kyle, who is a Republican senator from Arizona, who declared the happiest day of his life. You know, not the birth of his children, not the day he got married, you know, not even the day he graduated from law school or elected to the Senate. It was killing the CTBT, you know, and we don't have those of us who seek a transformation in U.S. nuclear weapon policy, we don't have a individual with courage and deeply warped priorities to say that the happiest day of his life is getting the CTBT, or the happiest day of her life is getting, you know, the Star Treaty ratified. And so, I presume that organization at the grassroots level will, you know, has the prospect of producing one of these people. But until we have one, we're going to use
it. What's the CDT?
A comprehensive test ban treaty, which 10 years ago was brought to the Senate for their consent and approval, and they rejected it, which was a big blow.
I meant to say they failed to ratify.
Okay, they failed to ratify. They rejected it. You can quote me on that. And so President Obama has said he will bring it up again. It's going to be tight because it needs two-thirds of the Senate to approve it.
But terrifyingly, right now, exactly the same thing is happening in 1999, which is Senator Kyle is going around and lining up Republican votes against the treaty, and the administration is doing nothing. They're getting their papers in order. So they're commissioning studies, and I'm sorry, I want you to finish the study, but the President of the United States has to be on the phone every day when Dick Lugar, it's like, how's your health? it's really important to me, and they're not doing it.
We're doing some of that in Indiana, but it would be great if all of it did. Okay, I think we have time for, I have binders, and they're like gathering. Yeah, right. So, and how about one last question, and then you can corner our speakers. Because next up is lunch, I believe. Okay, George.
So extended insurance, who wants it or needs it? Do you need to pay for it?
Very interesting point. On both these last two questions again, I would encourage a lot more thoughtful study that on the one hand, it involves some technical issues. On one hand, for example, our society is now interconnected in a way that's completely orders of magnitude different than anything that could have been conceived for Japan. Go back and read the effect of the atomic bombings on a war hardened Japan and think of what the implications would be in our highly interconnected network society. So that's one. And the related one, it has to do with a broader international network, and there are a lot of myths out there, and what is hard to ignore is the Japanese press have been playing quite an interesting role in the last 6 months in pointing out that there have been all sorts of arrangements and agreements between our countries, and can sort of ask the question of, who's trapping who in that relationship? I don't mean to pick on the Japanese. Similarly, in Germany, you see questions asked in Italy and Turkey, among other places. Now, these have to be taken very seriously, and I will say that although it was not part of the Congressional Commission to study the strategic posture of the United States, the Perry Schlesinger Commission that reported out earlier this summer, my understanding is that they were exposed to international input that I'm told was very, very effective and surprising for a number of individuals, as they heard, I can't quote the country, but one of the most pacifist in the country, please don't drop your nuclear deterrent. So we need discussion, and we need open discussion.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Fortunately, we have lunch. And just to remind you that a last-minute addition, I'm not even sure it's in the schedule, is Representative Ed Markey, who has been a champion on these issues as well as climate change issues, will give a talk during lunch. And maybe, do you know where lunch is?
Right.